but it seemed rude to interrupt. She fell silent and smiled. Harold smiled too, but this was because he had no idea what to say next. "So she knows you're walking," said the family man in the far corner. He wore a short-sleeved Hawaiian shirt, and his arms and chest sprouted curls of dark hair. He leaned back expansively, rocking on the back legs of his chair, the way Maureen used to reprimand David for doing. You could feel his doubt all the way across the breakfast lounge. "I left a telephone message. I also sent a letter." "That's all?" "There wasn't much time for anything else." The businessman pinned Harold with his cynical expression. It was clear he also saw straight through him.
"There were two young men who set out from India," said the plump woman. "It was a peace march in 1968. They went to the four nuclear corners of the world. They took tea and asked the heads of state that if ever they were on the verge of pressing the red button, they should brew a pot first and reflect." Her friend nodded her head brightly.
The room seemed hot and closed in, and Harold longed for air. He stroked the length of his tie, reassuring himself of his own presence, but he felt he was all the wrong shape. "He's awfully tall," his Auntie May had said of him once, as if this was something you could rectify, like a leaking tap. Harold wished he had not talked to the hotel guests about the walk. He wished no one had mentioned religion. He didn't object to other people believing in God, but it was like being in a place where everyone knew a set of rules and he didn't. After all, he had tried it once and found no relief. And now the two kind ladies were talking about Buddhists and world peace, and he was nothing to do with those things. He was a retired man who had set out with a letter. He said, "A long time ago, my friend and I worked together. It was my job to check the pubs were running smoothly. She was in the financial department. Sometimes we visited them together and I gave her a lift." His heart was pounding so fast that he felt unwell. "She did something for me, and now she is dying. I don't want her to die, I want her to keep living." The nudity of his words took him by surprise, as if it was Harold himself who was wearing no clothes. He looked down at his lap, and the room fell once more into silence. Now that he had conjured her into his mind, Harold wanted to linger with the image of Queenie, but he was too acutely aware of everyone in the room scrutinizing him and doubting what they saw. And so the memory of her slipped away, just as the real woman had done all those years ago. Briefly, he remembered the empty seat at her desk and how he had stood beside it, waiting, not believing she had gone and wouldn't come back. He wasn't hungry anymore. He was about to step out for fresh air when the waitress swooped out of the kitchen bearing a full fried breakfast. Harold ate all that he could, but it wasn't much. He chopped the bacon rasher and sausage into scraps and hid them in a tidy line beneath his knife and fork, like David used to. And then he retired. Back in his room, Harold attempted to smooth the sheets and floral quilt over the bed the way Maureen would. He wanted to clear himself away. At the sink, he dampened his hair and patted it to one side and picked at the bits in his teeth with his forefinger. Reflected in the mirror, he could see traces of his father. It wasn't just in the blue of his eyes, but in the set of his mouth, slightly protruded, as if he were permanently storing something behind his lower lip, and in the expanse of his forehead, where once there had been a fringe. He peered a little closer, trying to believe he could find his mother too, but apart from her height, she had left no trace of herself. Harold was an old man, not a walker, let alone a pilgrim. Who was he hoping to fool? He had spent his adult life sitting in confined spaces, his skin stretched like a million tessellations over tendons and bones. He thought of all the miles between himself and Queenie, and Maureen's reminder that the furthest he had ever walked was to the car. He thought, too, of the Hawaiian shirt laughing, and the businessman's skepticism. They were right. He didn't know the first thing about exercise, or ordnance survey maps, or even the open land. He should pay his bill and take the bus home. He closed the bedroom door without making any noise, and it was like saying goodbye to something he hadn't even started. As Harold crept downstairs to the reception, his shoes on the carpet made no noise at all. He was replacing his wallet in his back pocket when the door of the breakfast lounge burst open. The waitress emerged, followed by the two grey ladies and the businessman. "We were worrying you had left," said the waitress, smoothing her red hair and slightly out of breath.
"We wanted to say bon voyage," piped up the plump lady. "I do hope you make it," said her tall friend.
The businessman pressed his card into Harold's palm.
"If you make it as far as Hexham, you should look me up."
They believed in him. They had looked at him in his yachting shoes, and listened to what he said, and they had made a decision in their hearts and minds to ignore the evidence and to imagine something bigger and something infinitely more beautiful than the obvious. Remembering his own doubt, Harold was humbled.
"Oh, that is so kind," he said softly.
He shook their hands and thanked them. The waitress nipped her face towards his and kissed the air above his ear. It was possible that as Harold turned to leave, the businessman snorted or even grimaced, and it was also possible that from the breakfast lounge came a shout of laughter, followed by a suppressed giggle. But Harold did not dwell on that. Such was his gratitude. He heard and laughed with them.
"I'll see you in Hexham," he promised, and threw a large wave as he strode towards the road.
The pewter sea lay behind, while ahead of him was all the land that led to Berwick, where once again there would be sea. He had started, and in doing so, Harold could already see the end. Chapter 5 Harold and the Barman and the Woman with Food. It was a perfect spring day. The air was sweet and gentle, and the sky stretched high, an intense blue. Harold was certain that the last time he had peered through the net drapes of Fosbridge Road, the trees and hedges were dark bones and spindles against the skyline. Yet now that he was out, and on his feet, it was as if everywhere he looked the fields, gardens, trees and hedgerows had exploded with growth. A canopy of sticky young leaves clung to the branches above him. There were startling yellow clouds of forsythia, trails of purple aubrietia. A young willow shook in a fountain of silver. The first of the potato shoots fingered through the soil, and already tiny buds hung from the gooseberry and currant shrubs, like the earrings Maureen used to wear. The abundance of new life was enough to make him giddy. With the hotel behind him, and few cars on the road, it occurred to Harold how vulnerable he was, a single figure, without his mobile phone. If he fell, or if someone sprang out of the bushes, who would hear his cries? A cracking of branches sent him scurrying forward, only to look back, with his heart wildly beating, and discover a pigeon regaining its balance in a tree. As time passed, and he found his rhythm, he began to feel more certain. England opened beneath his feet, and the feeling of freedom, of pushing into the unknown, was so exhilarating, he had to smile. He was in the world by himself, and nothing could get in the way or ask him to mow the lawn. Beyond the hedgerows, the land fell away to his left and right. A small copse of trees had been shaped by the wind into a quiff. He thought of his own thick hair when he was a teenager, slicked to a peak every day with gel. He would head north towards South Brent, where he would find modest accommodation for the night. From there, he would follow the A38 to Exeter. He couldn't recall the exact mileage, but in the old days he would allow a comfortable hour and 20 minutes for the drive. Harold walked the single-track lanes, and the walls of hedgerow were so dense and high, it was like journeying through a trench. It surprised Harold how fast and angry cars seemed when you were not in one. He took off his waterproof jacket and folded it over his arm. He and Queenie must have driven this way countless times, and yet he had no memory of the scenery. He must have been so caught up in the day's agenda and arriving punctually at their destination that the land beyond the car had been no more than a wash of one green and a backdrop of one hill. Life was very different when you walked through it. Between gaps in the banks, the land rolled up and down, carved into checkered fields and lined with ridges of hedging and trees. He had to stop to look. There were so many shades of green, Harold was humbled. Some were almost a deep velvety black, others so light they verged on yellow. Far away, the sun caught a passing car, maybe a window, and the light trembled across the hills like a fallen star. How was it he had never noticed all this before? Pale flowers, the name of which he didn't know, pooled the foot of the hedgerows, along with primroses and violets. He wondered if, all those years ago, Queenie had looked out from her passenger window and seen these things.
"This car smells of sugar," Maureen had said once,
pulling at the air with her nostrils.
"Violet sweets."
He had taken care after that to drive home at night with the windows open. When he arrived in Berwick, he would buy a bouquet. He pictured himself striding into the hospice and Queenie sitting in a pleasant chair by a sunny window, waiting for his arrival. The nursing staff would stop whatever they were doing and watch him pass, and the patients would be cheering, maybe even clapping, because he had come such a long way, of course. And Queenie would be laughing in that quiet way of hers as she took the flowers in her arms. Maureen used to wear a sprig of blossom or an autumn leaf in the buttonhole of her dress. Must have been just after they were married. Sometimes, if there wasn't a button, she'd slide it over her ear and the petals would fall into her hair. It was almost funny. He hadn't thought of that in years. The car slowed and drew to a halt. It was so close Harold had to crush his body into the nettles. The window lowered. There was loud music, but he couldn't see the faces.
"Off to see your girlfriend, Granddad!"
Harold gave a thumbs up, waiting for the stranger to pass. His skin fizzed where it had been stung. On he went, one foot in front of the other. Now that he accepted the slowness of himself, he took pleasure in the distance he covered. Far ahead, the horizon was no more than a blue brushstroke, pale as water, and unbroken by houses or trees. But sometimes it blurred as if the land and the sky had bled into one another and become matching halves of the same thing. He passed two vans, nose to nose, their drivers arguing over which of them should reverse to a passing point. His body ached for food. He thought of the breakfast he had not eaten, and his stomach twisted. At the California Cross Junction, Harold stopped for an early pub lunch and chose two rounds of ready-made cheese sandwiches from a basket. Three men coated in plaster dust, like ghosts, were discussing a house they were renovating. A few other drinkers glanced up from their pints. But this had never been his patch, and thankfully he knew no one. Harold carried his lunch and lemonade to the door, blinking at the onslaught of light as he stepped out into the beer garden. Lifting the glass to his mouth, a swell of saliva pooled his tongue, and when he dug his teeth into the sandwiches, the nuttiness of the cheese and the sweetness of the bread exploded onto his taste buds with such vigour it was as if he had never eaten before. As a boy, he tried to chew without noise. His father didn't like to hear him masticate. Sometimes he said nothing, only held his ears and closed his eyes, as if the boy were a pain inside his head. Other times he said Harold was a dirty beggar. "Takes one to know one," his mother would answer, screwing out a cigarette. It was nerves, he heard a neighbour say. The war had made people funny. And sometimes, as a boy, he had wanted to touch his father, to stand close beside him and know the feeling of an adult arm around his shoulder. He'd wanted to ask what happened before he was born and why his father's hands trembled when he reached for his glass.
"That boy's staring at me," said his father sometimes.
His mother would swipe his knuckles, not hard, but as if she were brushing off a fly, and say, "Leave off, sonny. Go and play outside." It surprised him that he was remembering all this. Maybe it was the walking. Maybe you saw even more than the land when you got out of the car and used your feet. The sun poured like warm liquid on Harold's head and hands. He removed his shoes and socks under the table, where no one would see or smell them, and examined his feet. The toes were moist and an angry crimson. Where the shoe met his heel, the skin had become inflamed. The blister was a tight pod. He paddled the arches of his feet in the soft grass and closed his eyes, feeling tired, but knowing that he mustn't sleep. It would be difficult to keep going if he stopped for too long.
"Enjoy it while it lasts."
Harold turned, afraid of finding someone he knew. It was only the landlord, partially eclipsing the sun. He was as tall as Harold, but of wider build, dressed in a rugby shirt and long shorts, and those sandals that Maureen said looked like Cornish pasties. Harold returned his feet quickly to his yachting shoes.
"Don't let me disturb you," said the landlord, rather loud and without moving.
In Harold's experience, publicans often behaved as if it was their responsibility to suggest there was a conversation happening, even in silence, and that it was hugely entertaining.
"The nice weather makes people want to do something. Take my wife. First sunny day, she cleans out the kitchen cupboards."
"Maureen seemed to clean all year round. Houses don't clean themselves," she'd mutter. Sometimes she cleaned the bits she had just cleaned. It wasn't like living in a house, but more a question of hovering over the surfaces. He didn't say that, however. He merely thought it.
"I haven't seen you before," said the landlord. "Are you visiting?"
Harold explained that he was passing through. He had retired 6 months ago, he said, from the brewery. He belonged to the old days when the reps drove out every morning and there was less technology.
"So you must have known Napier."
The question took him unawares. Harold cleared his throat and said Napier had been his boss until he was killed in a car crash 5 years back.
"I know you shouldn't speak ill of the dead," said the landlord, "but he was a vicious sod. I saw him half kill a man once. We had to pull him off."
Harold felt a twisting in his gut. It would be better not to speak about Napier. Instead, he explained how he had set off with the letter for Queenie and realized it wasn't enough. Before the landlord could point it out, he admitted he had no phone, walking boots, or map, and that he probably appeared ridiculous.
"It's not a name you hear much, Queenie," said the landlord. "It's old-fashioned."
Harold agreed and said she had been an old-fashioned sort of person. Quiet and always wearing a brown wool suit, even in the summer months. The landlord folded his arms, resting them over the soft shelf of his belly, and widened his feet, as if he had something to tell and it might take a while. Harold hoped it wasn't concerning the distance between Devon and Berwick-upon-Tweed.
"There was this young lady I knew once. Lovely girl. Lived in Tunbridge Wells. She was the first girl I ever kissed, and she let me do a few things besides, if you get my drift. This young lady would have done anything for me. I just couldn't see it. Too busy trying to get on in the world. It was only years later, when I was invited to the wedding, that I saw what a lucky bastard the chap marrying her was."
Harold felt he should say that he had never been in love with Queenie. Not in that way, but it seemed rude to interrupt.
"I fell apart. Started drinking. Got myself in a right mess, if you know what I mean."
Harold nodded.
"Spent 6 years in prison in the end. My wife laughs, but these days I do craft work, table decorations. I get the baubles and the baskets off the internet. The truth is..." And here he wiggled his ear with his finger. "We've all got a past. We've all got things we wish we'd done or hadn't. Good luck to you. I hope you find the lady.
The landlord removed his finger from his ear and studied it with a frown.
If you're lucky, she'll get there this afternoon.
There was no point in correcting him. He couldn't expect people to understand the nature of his walk, or even the exact whereabouts of Berwick-upon-Tweed. Harold thanked him and continued on his way. He remembered how Queenie kept a notebook in her handbag to tot up their mileage. It wasn't in her to tell a lie. At least not one that was intentional. A flicker of guilt propelled him forward. During the afternoon, his blister became more painful. He found a way of shoving his toes towards the front of the shoe to avoid the leather biting into his ankle. He wasn't thinking of Queenie, and he wasn't thinking of Maureen. He wasn't even seeing the hedgerows or the horizon or the passing cars. He was the words, "You will not die," and they were also his feet. Only sometimes the words marched themselves in different orders, and he realized at the start that his head was chanting, "Die you will not," or "Not will you die," or even plain "Not, not, not." The sky above him was the same sky that hung over Queenie Hennessy, and he knew with increasing certainty that she had learned what he was doing and was waiting. He knew he was going to reach Berwick, and that all he had to do was place one foot in front of the other. The simplicity of it was joyful. If he kept going forward, he would, of course, arrive. The land lay still, interrupted only by the traffic that rustled the leaves as it rushed past. The sound could almost convince him he was back at the sea. Harold found himself halfway through a memory that he was not aware of conjuring into his mind. When David was 6, they had gone to the beach at Bantham, and he had started swimming out. Maureen had shouted, "David, come back! Come back right now!" Only the more insistently she called, the smaller the little boy's head became. Harold had followed her to the water's edge and stopped to unlace his shoes. He was about to pull them off when a Coast Guard had sprinted past, tearing off his T-shirt and hurling it behind him as an afterthought. The chap had gone ploughing into the water until he was waist-deep, and then he had plunged his whole body in, slicing through the waves until he reached the child. He had carried David back in his arms. The boy's ribs stuck out like fingers, and his mouth was blue. "He was lucky," the Coast Guard said. He addressed Maureen, not her husband. Harold withdrew a step or two. "There's a strong current out there." His white canvas shoes shone wet in the sun. And Maureen had never said it, but Harold knew what she was thinking, because he was thinking the same thing. Why had he stopped for his laces when his only son was in danger of drowning? Years later, he had said to David, "Why did you keep swimming that day on the beach? Couldn't you hear us?" David must have been a young teenager. He had gazed back at Harold with his beautiful brown eyes that were half boy, half man, and he had shrugged. "I don't know. I was already in shit. Seemed easier to stay in it than come back." Harold had said it was better not to swear, especially in his mother's hearing. And David had said something like, "Bug off." Harold wondered why he was remembering all this. His only child ploughing an escape into the sea and telling him years later to bug off. The pictures had come to him whole, as if they were part of the same moment. Points of light dropped on the sea like rain, while David gazed at Harold with an intensity that seemed to undo him. He had been afraid. That was the truth. He had untied his laces because he was terrified that when there were no more excuses, he would not be up to saving his son. And what was more, they all knew it. Harold, Maureen, the Coast Guard, even David. Harold pushed his feet forward. He feared there would be more, the images and thoughts that crammed his head at night, keeping him awake. Years later, Maureen had accused him of almost drowning their son, He fixed his attention on what was outside. The road stretched between the dense corridors of hedgerow, and light sieved through the cracks and fissures. Fresh shoots speared the earth banks. Far away, a clock chimed three. Time was passing. He drove his feet faster. Harold became aware of a dry sensation in his mouth. He tried not to imagine a glass of water, but now that his head had produced the image, it also conjured the feel and taste of cold liquid in his mouth, and his body grew weak with the need for it. He walked very carefully, trying to stabilize the ground while it tipped beneath his feet. Several cars slowed, but he waved them on, not wanting their attention. Each breath seemed too angular to pass through the cavities of his chest. There was no choice but to stop at the first home he came to. He secured the iron gate and hoped there weren't dogs. The bricks of the house were new and grey. The evergreen hedging shaved hard back like a wall. Tulips grew in pert rows in beds that were without weeds. To the side hung a line of washing. Several large shirts, trousers, skirts, and a woman's bra. He looked away, not wanting to see things he shouldn't. As a teenager, he'd often gazed at his aunt's pegged-up corsets, brassieres, support knickers and stockings. It was the first time he had realized the female world held secrets he wanted to know. He rang the doorbell of the house and leaned against the wall. When a woman answered, her face dropped. He wanted to reassure her not to worry, but his insides felt stripped. He could barely move his tongue. She hurried to fetch him a drink, and as he took the glass, his hands trembled. The iced water broke over his teeth, his gums, the roof of his mouth, and rushed to his throat. He could have cried at the rightness of it.
"Are you sure you're all right?"
she said. After she had fetched him a second glass and he had emptied that too, she was a wide woman, wearing a creased dress, child-bearing hips, Maureen would have said. Her face was so weathered the skin looked slapped.
"Do you need to rest?"
Harold promised he was feeling better. He was eager to get back to the road, and he didn't want to intrude on a stranger. Besides, he felt he had already broken an unspoken English rule in asking for help. To do more would be to align himself with something both transient and unknown. In between the words, he sought quick, rasping breaths. He assured her he was walking a long way, but probably hadn't got the hang of it yet. He hoped it would raise a smile, but she didn't seem to see the funny side. It was a long time since he had made a woman laugh. "Wait here," she said. Again she disappeared into the stillness of the house, to return with two fold-up chairs. Harold helped her to open them and repeated that he should get going, but she sank her body down as if she too had made a journey and urged him to join her. "Just for a moment," she said. "It'll do us both good." Harold lowered his limbs into the seat beside hers. A heavy stillness crept over him, and after resisting for a moment, he closed his eyes. The light glowed red against his eyelids, and the sounds of birdsong and passing cars merged into one that was both inside him and far away. When he woke, she had set a small table at his knees with a plate of bread and butter and slices of apple. She gestured with the upturned palm of her hand towards the plate, as if she were showing him the way forward. "Please, help yourself." Even though he hadn't been aware of his hunger, now that he saw the apple, his stomach felt scooped out. Besides, it would be rude not to accept after she had taken the trouble. He ate greedily, apologizing, but unable to stop. The woman watched and smiled. And all the while she played with a quarter of apple, turning it between her fingers, as if it were something curious she had picked up from the ground.
"You'd think walking should be the simplest thing," she said at last. "Just a question of putting one foot in front of the other. But it never ceases to amaze me how difficult the things that are supposed to be instinctive really are."
She wet her lower lip with her tongue, waiting for more words.
"Eating," she said at last. That's another one. Some people have real difficulties with that. Talking, too. Even loving. They can all be difficult.
She watched the garden, not Harold. Sleeping, he said. She turned.
Don't you sleep?
Not always. He reached for more apple. There was another silence. Then she said,
Children.
I beg your pardon?
There's another one.
He glanced again at her washing line and the perfect rows of flowers. He felt the resounding absence of young life.
Did you have any yourself? She said.
Just one. Harold thought of David, but it was too much to explain. He saw the boy as a toddler and how his face darkened in sunshine like a ripe nut.
He wanted to describe the soft dimples of flesh at his knees, and the way he walked in his first pair of shoes, staring down, as if unable to credit they were still attached to his feet. He thought of him lying in his cot, his fingers so appallingly small and perfect over his wool blanket. You could look at them and fear they might dissolve beneath your touch. Mothering had come so naturally to Maureen. It was as if another woman had been waiting inside her all along, ready to slip out. She knew how to swing her body so that a baby slept, how to soften her voice, how to curl her hand to support his head. She knew what temperature the water should be in his bath and when he needed to nap, and how to knit him blue wool socks. He had no idea she knew these things, and he had watched with awe, like a spectator from the shadows. It both deepened his love for her and lifted her apart, so that just at the moment when he thought their marriage would intensify, it seemed to lose its way, or at least set them in different places. He peered at his baby son with his solemn eyes and felt consumed with fear. What if he was hungry? What if he was unhappy? What if other boys hit him when he went to school? There was so much to protect him from, Harold was overwhelmed. He wondered if other men had found the new responsibility of parenting as terrifying, or whether it had been a fault that was only in himself. It was different these days. You saw men pushing buggies and feeding babies, with no worries at all. I hope I haven't upset you, said the woman beside him.
No, no.
He stood and shook her hand. I'm glad you stopped, she said. I'm glad you asked for water.
He returned to the road before she could see that he was crying. The lower creases of Dartmoor loomed to his left. He could see now that what had appeared to be a vague blue mass on the shoulder of the horizon was a series of purple, green, and yellow peaks, unbroken by fields, and topped at the highest points with boulders of stone. A bird of prey, maybe a buzzard, swung over the land, skimming the air, suspended. Harold asked himself if years ago he shouldn't have pressed Maureen to have another baby.
David is enough, she had said. He's all we need.
But sometimes he was afraid that having one son was too much to bear. He wondered if the pain of loving became diluted the more you had. A child's growing was a constant pushing away. When their son had finally rejected them for good, they dealt with it in different ways. There was anger for a while, and then there was something else. It was like silence, but had an energy and violence of its own. In the end, Harold had come down with a cold, and Maureen had moved into the spare room. Somehow or other, neither of them had mentioned it, and somehow or other, she had never moved back. Harold's heel stung, and his back ached, and now the soles of his feet were beginning to burn. Even the smallest flint caused him pain. He had to keep stopping to remove a shoe and shake it empty. From time to time, he also found that his legs buckled for no apparent reason, as if they had been jellied, causing him to stumble. His fingers were throbbing, but maybe that was because they were not used to being swung back and forth in a downward direction. And yet, despite all this, he felt intensely alive. A lawnmower started up in the distance, and he laughed out loud. Harold joined the A3121 towards Exeter, and after a mile of heavy traffic at his back, he took the B3372, following the grass verges. When a group of professional-looking walkers caught him up, Harold stood out of their way and waved them past. They exchanged pleasantries about the good weather and the landscape, but he didn't tell them about heading for Berwick. He preferred to keep that tucked in his head, like Queenie's letter in his pocket. As they moved ahead, he observed with interest that they all had backpacks, that some of them had loose-fitting tracksuits, and that others were equipped with sun visors, binoculars, and telescopic hiking sticks. None was wearing yachting shoes. A few waved, and one or two laughed. Harold didn't know if they were doing it because they thought he was a hopeless case, or because they were admiring him. But either way, he found it didn't really matter. He was already different from the man who had set out from Kingsbridge, and even from the small hotel. He was not someone off to the postbox. He was walking to Queenie Hennessy. He was beginning again. When he had first heard the news about her joining the brewery, he was surprised. "Apparently there's a woman starting in the finances department," he had told Maureen and David. They were eating in the best room, back in the days when she loved to cook and it was used for family meals. Now that he thought about this scene, he could see it was Christmas, because the conversation was reliving itself with the added detail of festive paper hats. "Is that supposed to be interesting?" David had said. It must have been his A-level year at the grammar school. He was dressed head to foot in black, and his hair almost tipped his shoulders. He was not wearing a paper hat. He had skewered it with his fork. Maureen smiled. Harold didn't expect her to stand up for him because she loved her son, and that was right, of course. He only wished that sometimes he didn't feel so outside, as if what bonded them was their dissociation from him. David said, "A woman won't last at the brewery." "Apparently she's very well qualified. Everyone knows about Napier. He's a thug, a capitalist with sadomasochistic tendencies." "Mr. Napier is not so bad." David laughed out loud. "Father," he said, the way he did, suggesting the bond between them was a whim of irony rather than blood. "He had someone kneecapped. Everyone knows." "I'm sure he didn't." "For stealing from the petty cash tin." Harold said nothing. He mopped a sprout in gravy. He too knew the rumours, but he didn't like to think about them. "Well, let's hope the new woman isn't a feminist," David continued. "Or a lesbian or a socialist, eh, father?" He had evidently finished with Mr. Napier and was moving to subjects closer to home. Briefly, Harold met his son's challenging eyes. In those days, they still had their sharpness. It was uncomfortable to engage with them for long. "I don't object to people being different," he said. But his son merely sucked his teeth and glanced at his mother. "You read the Daily Telegraph," he said. And after that, he had pushed back his plate and stood, his body so pale and hollow, Harold could barely look. "Eat, love," Maureen called, but David shook his head and slunk out, as if his father was enough to put anyone off their Christmas lunch. Harold had looked to Maureen, but she was already on her feet, clearing away the plates. "He's clever, you see," she said, and implicit in the remark was the conviction that cleverness was both an excuse for everything and out of their reach. "I don't know about you, but I'm too full for sherry trifle." She bent her head and slipped off her paper hat, like something she had outgrown. and then she went to do the washing up. Harold arrived at South Brent in the late hours of the afternoon. He trod paving stones again, and was struck both by their smallness and their regularity. He came to cream-coloured houses and front gardens and garages with central locking systems, and he felt the triumph of someone returning to civilization after a long voyage. In a small shop, Harold bought plasters, water, an aerosol can of deodorant, a comb, a toothbrush, plastic razors, shaving foam, washing powder, and 2 packets of rich tea biscuits. He took a room with a single bed and framed prints of extinct parrots on the wall, where he carefully examined his feet before applying plasters to the weeping blister on his heel and the swellings on his toes. His body throbbed with a deep aching. He was exhausted. He had never walked so far in a day, but he had covered 8.5 miles, and he was hungry for more. He would eat and call Maureen from a payphone, and after that he would sleep. The sun slipped over the edge of Dartmoor and filled the sky with russet cloud. The hills were shaded an opaque blue, and the cows grazing them glowed a soft apricot against the dying light. Harold couldn't help wishing that David knew he was walking. He wondered if Maureen would talk to him about it, and the words she would use. The stars began to prick the night sky, one after another, so that the growing darkness trembled. Even as he looked, he found them. For the second night in a row, Harold slept without dreaming. Chapter 6 Maureen and the Lie. At first, Maureen was convinced Harold would come back. He would phone, and he would be cold and tired, and she would have to go and fetch him, and it would be the middle of the night, and she would have to put a coat on over her nightdress and find her driving shoes. And all this would be Harold's fault. She had slept fitfully with the lamp on and the phone beside the bed, but he had neither rung nor come home. She kept going over all that had happened, the breakfast and the pink letter, and Harold not speaking, only weeping in silence. The smallest detail lurked in her mind, the way he had folded his reply twice and slipped it in the envelope before she could see. Even when she tried to think about something else, or nothing at all, she couldn't stop the picture swimming into her head, of Harold staring at Queenie's letter, as if something deep inside him was undoing. She wanted very much to speak to David, but she didn't know how she would say it. Harold's walk was still too confusing and humiliating, and she was afraid that if she spoke to David she would miss him, and it would be more hurt than she could bear. So when Harold said he was walking to Berwick, did he mean that once he got there he was staying? Well, he could go if he wanted. She should have seen it coming, like mother, like son. Although she had not met Joan, and Harold never spoke of her, what kind of woman packs a suitcase and leaves without even a note? Yes, Harold could go. There were times when she herself had been tempted to call it a day. It was David who kept her at home, not marital love. She could no longer recall the details of how she had first met Harold, or what she had seen in him, only that he had picked her up at some municipal dance, and that on meeting him, her mother had found him common. "Your father and I had better things in mind," she had said, in that clipped way of hers. In those days Maureen had not been one to listen to other people. So what if he had no education? So what if he had no class? So what if he rented a basement room and did so many jobs he barely slept? She looked at him, and her heart tipped sideways. She would be the love he had never had. Wife, mother, friend. She would be everything. Sometimes she looked back to the past and wondered where the reckless young woman was that she had been. Maureen went through his papers, but there was nothing to explain why he was walking to Queenie. There were no letters, no photographs, no half-scribbled directions. All she discovered in his bedside drawer was a picture of herself just after they were married, and another crumpled black-and-white one of David that Harold must have hidden there, because she clearly remembered sticking it in an album. The silence reminded her of the months after David had left, when the house itself seemed to hold its breath. She put on the television in the sitting room and the radio in the kitchen, but still it was too empty and quiet. Had he been waiting for Queenie for 20 years? Had Queenie Hennessy been waiting for him? It would be rubbish day tomorrow. Rubbish was Harold's department. She went online and ordered brochures from several companies who ran summer cruises. As dusk fell, Maureen saw she had no choice but to do the rubbish herself. She hauled the bag down the path and threw it against the garden gate, as if in being Harold's neglected duty, the rubbish was also to blame for his departure. Rex must have spotted her from an upstairs window, because he was at the fence as she came back. "Everything all right, Maureen?" She said briskly that it was, of course it was.
"Why is Harold not doing the rubbish this evening?"
Maureen glanced up at the bedroom window. Its emptiness struck her so forcefully that an unexpected rush of pain tore at the muscles inside her face. Her throat tightened.
"He's in bed,"
she forced a smile.
"Bed?" Rex's mouth dropped. "Why? Is Harold poorly?"
The man worried so easily. Elizabeth had once confided across washing lines that his mother's fussing had turned him into the most appalling hypochondriac. She said,
"It's nothing. He slipped. He twisted his ankle."
Rex's eyes widened like buttons.
"Did this happen during his walk yesterday, Maureen?"
"It was only a loose paving stone. He will be fine, Rex. What he needs is rest."
"That's shocking, Maureen. A loose paving stone. Oh, dear, oh dear."
He shook his head mournfully. From inside the house, the phone began to ring, and her heart leapt to her mouth. It was Harold. He was coming home. As she ran for the door, Rex was still at the fence, saying,
"You should make a complaint to the council about a loose paving stone."
"Don't worry," she called over her shoulder. "I will."
Her pulse was beating so fast she didn't know if she was going to laugh or cry. She darted to the phone and lifted the receiver, but the answer machine clicked on, and he rang off. She dialed 1471, but the caller's number was not available. She sat watching the phone, waiting for him to call again or return home. But he did neither. That night was the worst. She couldn't understand how anyone slept. She shook the batteries out of the bedside clock, but there was nothing she could do to stop the barking of dogs or the cars that screeched past towards the new housing at 3 in the morning, or even the shrieking of gulls that started up at first light. She lay very still, waiting for inertia, and sometimes a moment of unconsciousness stole over her, but then she would wake and remember again. Harold was walking to Queenie Hennessy. And reacquainting herself with this knowledge after the ignorance of sleep was even more painful than first hearing it on the telephone. It was a double deceit. But that was how it went. She knew that. You had to keep crawling up, not believing it, only to be punched back down again until the truth well and truly hit home. She opened Harold's bedside drawer and stared again at the 2 photographs he had hidden there. There was David in his first pair of shoes, balancing on one leg, and clinging on to her while lifting up his other foot as if to examine it. And the other was of herself, laughing so much her dark hair fell over her face in long sweeps. She was nursing a courgette that had grown to the size of a small child. Must have been taken just after they moved to Kingsbridge. When 3 large envelopes from cruise companies arrived, Maureen dropped them straight in the recycling box. Chapter 7 Harold and the Hiking Man and the Woman Who Loved Jane Austen. It had come to Harold's attention that several of the chaps at the brewery, including Mr. Napier, had developed a peculiar walk that caused them to shriek as if it were uncontrollably funny. "Look at this!" he'd hear them bragging from the yard. And one man would stick out an elbow like a chicken wing and lower his torso as if to widen the shape of his lower half before waddling forward.
"That's it! Fuck, that's it!"
the others would scream. Sometimes the whole gang would spit out their cigarettes and have a go. It had dawned on him, after several days of watching from a window, that what they were up to
was being the new woman in finances. They were being Queenie Hennessy and her handbag. Remembering this, Harold woke with an intense need to be back outside. Bright daylight frilled the curtains as if straining to get at him. To his relief, while his body was unyielding and his feet tender, he could move both. And the blister on his heel appeared less angry. His shirt, socks and underpants were strung on the radiator. He had rinsed them in hot water and washing powder the previous night. They were stiff and not quite dry, but they would do. He applied a tidy parade of plasters to both feet and carefully repacked the contents of the plastic bag. Harold was the only resident in the dining room, which was really a small front room with a three-piece suite pushed flat against a wall and a table for two positioned at the centre. It was lit by a lamp with an orange shade and smelt of damp. A glass-fronted cabinet exhibited a collection of Spanish dolls and dead blue bottles, dry as twists of tissue paper. The woman who owned the B&B said that the girl who helped was off. She spoke the word as if there was something unsavory about the girl's absence, as if she were maybe a piece of food that had to be disposed of. She put his breakfast on the table and watched him from the doorway, her arms folded. Harold was glad not to have to explain. He ate greedily and impatiently, staring out at the road beyond the window, and calculating how long it would take a man who wasn't used to walking to cover the 6 miles to Buckfast Abbey, let alone the further 480-plus to Berwick-upon-Tweed. Harold read the words of Queenie's letter, although he knew them now without looking. "Dear Harold, this may come to you as some surprise. I know it is a long time since we last met, but recently I've been thinking about the past. Last year I had an operation."
"I hate South Brent," said a voice.
Surprised, Harold looked up. There was no one except him and the owner, and it seemed unlikely she had spoken. She was still leaning against the doorframe with her arms folded and jiggling her leg, so that her slipper dangled from her foot on the verge of escape. Harold returned to his letter and his coffee, when the voice came again.
"We get more rain in South Brent than anywhere else in Devon."
Clearly it was the woman, although she still didn't look at him. Her face remained fixed towards the carpet, her lips an empty O, as if her mouth were speaking despite the rest of her. He wished he could say something helpful, but he couldn't think what it might be. Maybe his silence or simply his hearing was enough, because she went on.
"Even when it's sunny, I can't enjoy it. I think to myself, oh, yes, it's nice now, but it's not going to last. I'm either watching rain or waiting for it."
Harold refolded Queenie's letter and returned it to his pocket. Something was bothering him about the envelope, but he couldn't find in his mind what it was. Besides, it seemed rude not to give the woman his full attention, since she was evidently talking to him. She said,
"I won a holiday to Benidorm once. All I had to do was pack my suitcase, but I couldn't do it. They sent me the ticket in the post, and I never opened the envelope. Why is that? Why, when the chance to escape came, couldn't I take it?"
Harold frowned. He thought of all the years he hadn't spoken to Queenie.
"Maybe you were afraid," he said. "I had a friend once, but it took me a long time to see that she was. It was actually rather funny because we first met in a stationery cupboard."
He laughed, remembering the scene. But the woman didn't. It was probably difficult to imagine. She stopped the foot that had been swinging like a pendulum and studied her slipper as if she had not noticed it before.
"One day I will leave," she said.
She looked across the drab room and caught Harold's eye, and then at last she smiled. Contrary to David's predictions, Queenie Hennessy had not turned out to be a socialist, feminist, or lesbian. She was a stout, plain-looking woman with no waist and a handbag tucked over her forearm. It was well known that Mr. Napier considered women to be little more than ticking hormone bombs. He gave them jobs as barmaids and secretaries and expected in return the odd favour in the back of his Jaguar. So Queenie marked a new departure at the brewery, and one that Mr. Napier would not have made
had anyone other than her applied for the job. Her manner was quiet and unassuming. Harold overheard a young chap saying, "You forget she's a woman, really?" Within a matter of days there were reports that she had brought an unprecedented order to the financial department. But this did not seem to stop the impersonations and laughter that now filled the corridors. Harold hoped she didn't hear. He watched her sometimes in the canteen with her sandwiches wrapped in greaseproof paper. She had a way of sitting with the young secretaries and listening, as if she or they were not there at all. It was when he picked up his briefcase to go home one evening that he heard a snuffling sound from behind a cupboard door. He tried to walk past, but the noise didn't stop. He turned back. Edging the door open, to his relief he had found nothing at first, just boxes of paper. Then the sound had come again, more like a sob, and he had discovered a squat figure pressed against the wall with her back to him. Her jacket tugged at the seam that ran the length of her spine. "I do beg your pardon," he had said. He'd been on the point of closing the door again and rushing away, when she had started to weep.
"I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
"It's I who should apologize." Now he was half standing in the cupboard and half outside it, with a woman he didn't know crying into manila envelopes.
"I'm good at my job," she said.
"Of course." He glanced down the corridor, hoping one of the younger chaps would appear and talk to her. He had never been very good with emotion. "Of course," he said again, as if saying it repeatedly would be enough.
"I've got a degree. I'm not stupid."
"I know," he said, although, of course, this was not strictly true. He knew almost nothing about her.
"Then why is Mr. Napier always watching as if he's waiting for me to make a mistake? Why must they all laugh?"
Their boss was a mystery to Harold. He didn't know whether the rumours about the kneecapping were true, but he had seen the man reduce the toughest landlords to jelly. Only the previous week Napier had fired a secretary for touching his desk. He said, "I'm sure he thinks you are a very good accountant." He simply wanted to stop her crying.
"I need this job. It's not as if the rent pays itself, but I'm going to resign. Some mornings I don't even want to get up. My father always said I was too sensitive."
It was more information than Harold knew what to do with. Queenie dropped her head low, so that he could see the soft dark hairs at the nape of her neck. It reminded him of David, and he felt a rush of pity. "Don't resign," he said, stooping a little and softening his voice. He was speaking from the heart. "I found it hard to begin with, too. I felt out of place. But it will get better." She said nothing, and he wondered for a moment if she had even heard him. "Would you like to come out of the stationery cupboard now?" To his surprise, he held out his palm for her, and again to his surprise, she took it. Her hand was soft and warm against his. Outside the cupboard, she pulled it away quickly. Then she smoothed her skirt, as if Harold were a crease and she needed to brush him out.
"Thank you,"
she said a little coldly, although her nose was a violent red. She walked away from the stationery cupboard with her back straight and her neck tall, leaving Harold feeling that he was the one who had behaved out of turn. He supposed she had stopped thinking about resigning after that, because he looked out for her at her desk every day and she was there, working alone and without fuss. They rarely spoke. In fact, he began to notice that if he entered the canteen, she seemed to pack up her sandwiches and leave. Morning sun spilled gold over the highest peaks of Dartmoor, but in the shadows the ground was still brushed with a thin frost. Shafts of light struck the land ahead like torches, marking his journey forward. It would be another good day. Leaving South Brent, Harold met a man in his dressing gown who was leaving food on a saucer for the hedgehogs. He crossed the road to avoid dogs and further on he overtook a young tattooed woman, bawling beneath an upstairs window.
"I know you're there! I know you can hear me!"
She paced up and down, kicking at garden walls, her body brittle with fury, and every time she appeared on the point of giving up, she returned to the